Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass PNC. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Cass?
I'm doing great. We're joined by a very special guest, someone we've been building up to over many, many podcasts now, Elizabeth Lopato from The Verge. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you guys? I finally got some sleep.
Yeah, you were in New York the whole time, so you just got back to the West Coast. We haven't been struggling and waking up very early in the morning to cover this like you have, which according to some reports, you were out there at like 1 a.m. or midnight sometimes to get ready to get into the courtroom.
It was an embarrassing hour.
We talked to Molly last time and we hadn't gotten the verdict yet. I think everyone's probably aware that I'm not spoiling anything. He was guilty on all counts. But can you walk us through kind of the pulse of the courtroom as they built up to the verdict in the day or so before that?
So this was actually part of the reason I was getting up so early. I really wanted to see what things were like in the courtroom. I think Sam Kessler talked about this a little bit on a previous episode, but things often played differently in the courtroom than they did in Overflow or on crypto Twitter. So there were these moments that felt different. But I have to say, sort of starting with the recording of Caroline and building up to the cross of Sam Bankman-Fried, it felt like the jury was pretty fed up with him. And, you know, there were moments during the cross where I could see the jurors like making eye contact with each other. Like, you know, when you're on the subway and somebody's misbehaving and you just make eye contact with a stranger, like, do you see that shit? It was very that. That was kind of the mood building up to it. We had the charge conference, which was, you know, Judge Lewis Kaplan reading aloud 60 pages of how to think about these charges to the jury. And that was a little boring, but we did it. And then they were dismissed to go ponder their verdict. And while they were deliberating, the overflow rooms were closed. And so everybody came into the main courtroom. And then after about 4.5 hours, we got a verdict. And so all the lawyers came in. Sam's parents came in. You know, shit gets real at the verdict. It was very solemn. Four women stood and Sam stood. Court clerk Andy, who is sort of a recurring character throughout this. I'm not sure anybody necessarily wrote about him, but he was a minor character that we all pretty fond of in the room. You know, he went through and read the charges. How do you find? It was guilty, 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 guilty. And after that first or second guilty, Joseph Bankman, you know, doubled over. And Barbara Fried, you know, she kind of like put her hands over her face. And I saw the court sketch artist turn around and start sketching them. And there was just something really primal, I guess, about watching that specific kind of parental pain, which if you've ever witnessed it, you know what I'm talking about. It's not something that you forget easily. You know, these people were anguished and there was no privacy for them. And I know they benefited from Sam's fraud at FTX and may or may not have known what was going on, may or may not have been involved. There's certainly some indication that some of the campaign finance stuff Barbara Fried had been giving advice on. And, you know, Joe Bankman sat in some of those Signal chats. So, you know, it's possible they may have known more, but it was still like undeniable that these people were in a lot of pain, and also that they were like totally surrounded by reporters. The judge thanked the jury and dismissed them. And, you know, we took care of a couple of other matters about like when sentencing was going to be and so on. And then he got off the bench and the parents came up and there was sort of a border, like a little wooden, like waist-high border between the court itself and the gallery. And so they stood at the border waiting for Sam to turn around. And he didn't. He was talking to his lawyers, maybe because he didn't want us to see him. And then he started walking off and he glanced back at his mother and she crumpled. And it was, the two of them were like holding each other up. And that was sort of the end of the case. You know, there was a press conference afterwards, but for me, that was really the end of the thing. And it felt like we had sort of gone from like, you know, circus clown music to like a funeral dirge really abruptly. And so there was something like very solemn about it. And that was what I went home and wrote about. Because one of the things that I've been thinking about throughout this trial is why are we here? like, literally, why are we here? There's so much evidence. And even without the co-conspirators talking about, you know, Sam giving them direction, there's so much of the money flowing specifically to benefit Sam that I don't know how you could come to any other conclusion. Like, why would Caroline and Gary and Nishad just do this stuff because he's so nice? Like, come on. You know, I just remember thinking, like, Bernie Madoff just, like, turned himself in and was like, yeah, I'm guilty. You got me. And may have spared his family some, you know, public humiliation. And Sam certainly did not. And that really stuck with me.
You wrote an article, which we're obviously going to link to. Sam Bankman-Fried gambled on a trial and his parents lost is the title. And I had tweeted about this today, just saying that I appreciated your take. And I think part of why I appreciate it is because, especially considering that Bennett and I, like, are only, like, most of our beat is just fraud and bad baddies. Sometimes, I don't know, you hear about this with, like, police officers and stuff, where it's just they lose the empathy at some point. They stop feeling bad about the people that they're putting into prison. But I think it's super important to remember that these are actually just people. And speaking as somebody who's been to jail before and had to tell my parents I fucked up, like someone else has said publicly, I understand that it is a really tough moment for any parent. Or as you said, like, regardless of whether they're involved, which I think Bennett and I have both kind of discussed, that to us, it certainly feels like they played a pretty pivotal role in all of this and deserve to be scrutinized. But that doesn't take away from them being parents and seeing their son do something undeniably horrible at this point. Like, it is pretty much undeniable now what happened and that he was at the heart of it, and that it's, like, that's awful. And I think it's just very reasonable to point that out. And I had to push back some people on this, but I actually do just really appreciate you bringing a little bit of empathy to the court case, because it's been so obvious, as you said, from the very beginning, where it's like, pretty clear cut that Sam Bankman-Fried did this.
I mean, for me, one of the things that's been really riveting about this trial is the absolute scale of destruction here. So, you know, $8 billion is a lot of money. I don't think anybody was like, oh, gee whiz, he put it in his other pair of pants. It's a mistake. And, you know, all of those customers are now tied up in the bankruptcy proceedings. And that includes FTX employees, who I think were especially betrayed here because they believed it was real. Like, they believed they were working on something good, and they found out that was not the case. And I think that's pretty horrible. But the trial itself made it clear that this was unusual, because usually when you have something like Enron or you have a WorldCom or something, it's not your closest friends in the world who are taking the stand against you. You know what I mean? And you had Adam Yedidia, who was not involved in the conspiracy, but who testified against Sam and was one of his closest friends from college and was his roommate for many years. You had Gary Wong, who was also friend from college, roommate. Nishad Singh, who's known the family since high school. Like, these are not casual acquaintances. Like, this is your inner circle. These are the people you know best in the world, and they're taking the stand against you. Like, that is a level of, like, Shakespearean personal destruction almost. So there was that to me was really something astonishing to watch.
What's interesting to me is that, like, in many senses, this trial shouldn't have happened. Almost anyone with white-collar charges in SDNY going after them will find some kind of plea deal, because they recognize even if the deal isn't great, the outcome after trial is likely to be worse. But through and through, and I think we've re-emphasized this over and over, Cass in almost every episode has talked about how he expected that Sam was going to take the stand for the same reason he took this to trial, because it was a gamble. There was still a chance. And even, like, the way you described it, you go from, like, the happy clown music to suddenly the funeral dirge is, like, the story of gamblers all over. You stay in the glitz and glam until, like, the very last moment when there is nothing left. There's no more chance. You've got nothing left for one more roll. And so I think, like, the ending of this tragedy has been written for a long time. We've kind of seen where Sam Bankman-Fried has been going, but he has insisted until the very last time to keep stepping up and giving that wheel one more spin. And that's what got us here. And that's what's going to put him away for likely a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely a quality of like, you know, when the gambler has lost everything and he takes his wedding ring off and he's like, I'm going to win it back, and it doesn't happen. There was that kind of quality to it. But one of the things that I think is maybe underappreciated about how disastrous that cross-examination was is that Lewis Kaplan is the sentencing judge. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of points where it felt like Sam was lying directly to the judge. And again, you know, forget making a deal. Assume no deal is on the table. Just assume it, right? Assume he's not offered a deal. Just pleading guilty and saying you're sorry is going to help in terms of sentencing. You show repentance, you know, you make it clear that you're taking responsibility for your actions. Those are things that judges take into account when they think about sentencing. And so if you're up on the stand, not only saying, I didn't do it, and if I did it, it was fine, and I didn't mean it, and also, I don't recall anything I said in the last year and a half, and I am going to try to weasel my way out of all of these questions, and I'm going to answer the questions that I feel like answering and not the questions I'm being asked. Like, this sort of thing, you know, it doesn't win over a judge. It doesn't suggest that you're really taking responsibility for your actions, and it suggests a worse sentence. And that, I think, I'm going to be back in New York for the sentencing, so we'll see what it is. But that, I think, is an underappreciated aspect of why this was such a bad gamble.
Well, in his, so to be fair, yes, I agree. But to be fair, I think part of why Sam would argue the gamble isn't over yet, right? Like, he's still going to appeal. He's still sure. going to try to do a bunch of who knows what to try to figure a way out of this. First, we should talk about sentencing, which is supposed to happen in March. Odds for everyone are at least 20 years. That's what I'm hearing. I'm not a lawyer. None of us are lawyers here.
What's the Vegas line?
What are we thinking is going to happen here? As you said, he basically lied to the judge's face, and he's shown no remorse, is how it certainly feels. I guess remorse insofar as like a teenage boy sulking and saying like, I didn't mean to do that or whatever, but no real like, I'm actually genuinely sorry for my transgressions kind of stuff. Do you expect that to play a role in the sentencing? He's also a 31-year-old who has never committed a crime.
$8 billion is a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money. This is one of the biggest financial crimes of all time, straight up. And then again, there's this lack of remorse. So I think Kaplan is going to throw the book. You know, maybe one thing to keep in mind is that Kaplan is not often overturned on appeal. That's pretty rare, actually. This is as far as picks of judges go, this is like maybe one of the worst picks you can get. I would be very surprised if he gets less than 20. And I would not be entirely surprised if he got more than 20. Whether that's an appropriate sentence, I think, is a separate question. I think most nonviolent criminals in America get sentences that are way too long. But I can't imagine this is going to be something where Kaplan's like, oh yeah, 2 years home confinement, that's enough.
Sure. I also, to be fair, I don't think 2 years home confinement would be fair. Like, I do think there should be an actual level of punishment here. I think we're all probably on the same side where we go like, life sentence wouldn't be right and wouldn't feel fair. It's certainly possible. As you said, over 20 also seems very possible right now. And if you think about it, as a 31-year-old man, if he has to go to federal prison for 25 years, I mean, that is, what are you going to do after that? I don't know. Like, that's pretty much it. There's better ways to try to get some sort of retribution out of this, as opposed to like straight up revenge. Though it seems like people are pretty bloodthirsty on this one. Which brings me to another point. Jesse Eisinger specifically had said that he would prefer that these sentences be lighter for criminals like this. I think it makes sense for someone like Bernie Madoff, like him not never getting out of prison kind of makes sense to me, just based on the scale and his age, versus this is a 31-year-old who, even if he just gets a minimum wage job or something when he's 45. And also, people have said recidivism rates are like high for fraud. Like, how is Sam Bankman-Fried going to commit more fraud when he gets out of prison? I don't know how.
Is that a challenge?
Well, I guess we'll see. We'll find out.
I don't claim to be an expert in the American prison system or in sentencing. I think for most nonviolent crimes, you don't need to put people in for the very long. As for recidivism, yeah, I mean, maybe he'll do another one. And I imagine there are going to be a lot of people very closely watching every single one of his moves, because this was such an enormous scandal, really. One of the things that I keep thinking about, separately from whatever the criminal justice system will provide, is I keep going back to how thoroughly this guy has exploded his entire life. All of his friends have testified against him. Like, imagine, like, hold together those people, the equivalent of those people in your mind. Because after Adam Yedidia's testimony, I texted my best friend, who I've known since college, and was just like, dude, if you're ever testifying against me, I am so fucked. You know, this is his inner circle. These are the people he knows best in the world. Like, separately from whatever job he's going to get next, like, who is going to want to spend time with him?
Here's a question for you. Pre-trial, I think the way most people were beginning to think about Sam Bankman-Fried was that he was kind of a narcissistic sociopath. Do you think he still gave off that energy during the trial?
I'm not qualified to diagnose anybody. But I do think arrogance was a huge part of this. You know, I think he thought he knew better than everybody at every single stage of this business, you know, starting with Alameda and like the big schism that happened where half the company left because they didn't trust him. And continuing on throughout FTX and continuing on throughout the post-FTX collapse media tour, where just if your lawyer ever tells you to shut up, shut up.
That Tiffany Fong clip is crazy, where he's like, I told them to go fuck themselves. Never tell your lawyer to go fuck themselves. Like, that seems pretty obvious. And he comes from a law family. The whole thing is wild when it comes to that. I guess I asked that question because I'm like, okay, you're talking about your friend. If they ever, like, testified against you, you'd be screwed. And sure, me too. And Bennett probably also. Like, all of us, right? But is that the case for Sam? Like, Sam Bankman-Fried, from the testimony, I'm just like, how many friends does this guy actually have? Like, at least Bernie Madoff came across as kind of charismatic. Like, say what you will about the guy and how horrible he was, but during interviews and stuff, he at least comes off like a human being and a man who's accepting his responsibility and stuff. Sam Bankman-Fried doesn't give off any of that energy whatsoever. And I'm just, again, it goes back to this like gambling thing where I just go like, it seems like the whole world is a game. The next moves he's trying to think about as opposed to thinking about what he's losing right now, like his family and his friends and his job and everything.
I think that Sam Bankman-Fried has been pretty delusional for a pretty long time. And this is an ugly way to wake up from that kind of delusion. But I think that that is part of what we were seeing in court. You know, there were moments of the old charming Sam that we saw on direct, but that didn't really help him because he pivoted so quickly into just being the sullen child on cross that it came off as being fake. And the thing is, he can be charming in the sort of nerdy way that I can certainly see why people might, for instance, have warmed to him. I could see why Michael Lewis could have warmed to him if he's able to keep that up. But it didn't feel real when we got to the cross and he couldn't remember anything and he was sullen and sort of seemed to be pretty resentful of Danielle Sassoon's entire existence. It was really something to watch. And like, I couldn't help but notice that he and the other co-conspirators seemed really young for their age. And I say this because, like, you know, a number of the CoinDesk folks who were doing really excellent work during this trial are younger than they are and definitely seemed older and more mature in comparison. You know, these were adults who were like still younger than the co-conspirators who were, for whatever reason, sort of giving off like math camp forever vibes. So I just, you know, I do wonder how much he's actually encountered reality and how aware he is of reality. And, you know, there are moments like I was a philosophy major. I'm sorry. I know we're annoying. But there were moments where he was like, kind of like trying to rephrase questions or, mm-hmm. you know, play with the rules a little. And I've been in rooms where that plays, like, obviously. But this is not something that you can really do in normal conversation and have people be sympathetic to you. This is not how people talk. This is not something that's going to make the jury like you. And I don't know that he knew that. Like, he was just trying to win the argument by, like, redefining the terms. And it turns out there are situations in which you cannot do that.
What's interesting to me is, for better or worse, the first four chapters of Michael Lewis's book are basically a telling of Sam Bankman-Fried regularly being kind of disconnected from reality. Like, in terms of understanding the importance of various things that everyone around him seemed to understand. And in terms of, you mentioned, like, we get to the point early in Alameda's history where a huge amount of their money is missing, a huge portion of their loans have been called in, and the rest of the executives are leaving the firm because they recognize that Sam Bankman-Fried is not this trustworthy person. And still, in, like, Sam Bankman-Fried, he doesn't seem to note that any of these things are occurring, like, not at a level where he perceives it as a serious consequence or issue. And he goes out and recruits Carolyn. And even Carolyn says she didn't really have a full picture of, like, the extent of that when she agreed to join. And so, like, there is just year after year from early on until the seven verdicts were read, he has kind of existed in this state where he's been so divorced from that reality that, like, this was some kind of fantastic conclusion was inevitable in his story. And maybe the coin flips came up and there ended up being, like, 10,000 Earths, all with perfect effective altruism on them or something. But this time that did not happen.
You know, it's funny. I know the Michael Lewis book was really divisive. I understand Cass did not care for it.
No.
I really loved it. I really thoroughly enjoyed that book. It was not at all the book that Michael Lewis thought he wrote. And, like, I have been thinking about it ever since I read it. Like, the difference between the book that I read and the book that Michael Lewis thinks he wrote. Like, I'm going to be thinking about this for a long time. Because the portrait you get of Sam in this book is, like, this guy who, like, sucks. You know, there are all these moments, whether it's, you know, the bet with Asher where he's, like, humiliating his fellow intern at Jane Street, or later on, I think it was Serum, where, like, they had he reneged on some deal and, like, locked Serum because he was worried his executives wouldn't work hard enough if he actually rewarded them.
Yeah.
Like, there are all these moments where he's just like, yeah, and fuck you. And, like, Michael Lewis is like, but he's going to do wonderful things for the world. And I'm like, how?
To be fair, I think part of why I really didn't like it, perhaps part of why you enjoyed it so much, is I had seen over and over again for years and years on cryptocurrency Twitter what an enormous asshole Sam Bankman-Fried was to everyone. So, like, these revelations that Sam Bankman-Fried is an enormous asshole was like, uh-huh. And, but, like, yes, of course, there's, like, the Jane Street stories and these little things that give you insight into who he is. But I still think, like, for most people who were witnessing it, for most people, the book is probably fantastic and Michael Lewis is a fun writer. But yeah, for me, that was certainly not the case.
It does make it kind of interesting how effective being like this disaffective, delusional asshole worked for Sam Bankman-Fried, right? Like, he humiliated his co-workers at Jane Street, but that didn't stop them from letting him put on a bet that ended up losing them $300 million, right? And, like, even in his pitch meetings with Sequoia and stuff, you've talked about this before, Cass, he's not paying attention to the meeting. He's not paying attention to the people offering him millions of dollars. He's playing storybook brawl or whatever and not actually engaging with it. Like, him maintaining that has, at some level, I think he started to believe that, like, his own delusion was part of the secret to his success.
Most
yeah,
definitely.
I think that's great. I have to say, one of the things that I was thinking about as a member of the press corps is he had talked a lot about in the book and elsewhere about, you know, Shakespeare. How could Shakespeare be the best writer of all time? That's really stuck with me. And I just want to unpack it for a hot second, because first of all, I really like Shakespeare. But second of all, I think it shows you a little bit about how this guy thinks. You know, leave aside the Bayesian whatever. You don't need to know what that means. And, you know, leave aside also that we quote Shakespeare quite unknowingly all the time, because he's provided so much language and so many sort of images that we use in the day on a day to day basis. So many things that are now cliche. Like, forget that. People don't read Shakespeare. People see Shakespeare performed. You did not have to be literate to see Shakespeare. That has never been the case. It has literally never been the case. I went to school in rural Iowa, public school. So maybe I didn't get the best instruction, but my first encounter with Romeo and Juliet was a movie played by my teacher, who put a manila folder over the racy parts. It's not like you read Shakespeare. That's not how you encounter him. And so the whole premise of this argument that how could Shakespeare be the best writer of all time when people can't read was ridiculous. And if you think about it for even a second, outside of the premises that he set up, it's obviously ridiculous. But there's this inability to sort of step outside and see these other sort of contextual things. And I kept thinking, all of these people in the press corps, we are the people that he holds in contempt, because we are the people who are who care about these things, who like Shakespeare, and who think about things like food and sweaters and whatever else. There's a certain irony there that we're the peanut gallery. We're witnessing this.
I think that one of the most interesting things for me was the DMs between Sam Bankman-Fried and Kelsey Piper, because it was him kind of going completely mask off and talking about how many of these things he just truly doesn't care about, right? He doesn't care about the regulators. He doesn't even really care about most of the effective altruists or a lot of that things. He doesn't care about the rules. He doesn't really care about the philanthropy. He doesn't care about the politicians. And in this example with the Shakespeare that you're talking about, he doesn't care about art. He doesn't want to engage with any of these things on any level. It is an abstraction. Shakespeare exists as a number on a timeline, and he knows numerically people have written a lot of something since then, and surely something must be better than that thing. And I don't think many people who seriously think about art are regularly going around contending William Shakespeare is the greatest writer who ever lived or will ever live. I think most people who are seriously engaging with it want to look at Shakespeare's position and influence and what his writing meant in its time and how it's affected our time and all these other things. But for him, it's just, is it the best?
Well, it's a game. It's gamified, right? I mean, this is the perfect example of him turning literally everything into gambling, where it's numerically, you can't suggest that he's the best just based on how many sheer numbers of writers there have been and there will be. Sure, I get, I don't even know how to address that, but it's the same as you mentioned the, we're talking about the Shakespeare thing, but remember he literally said when they were getting into NFTs that he was I don't understand, I literally do not understand art at all. It is not something I have any way to conceptualize, which is what does that even mean? I might not be an art expert, but I can look at a painting and know whether I like it or not. So it's pretty hard for me to imagine being I look at every painting and they all look exactly the same. But that's what this guy was doing. And then figuring out numbers about which then therefore is the greatest artist or writer or whatever. But that all goes back into how he ran and operated a multi-billion-dollar business, which seems to all be on a coin flip.
There is one other thing that I just want to think about here. And again, this is in Michael Lewis's book, which I have just I cannot stop thinking about this book. It is one of the most interesting failures I think I've ever read. But there's this thing where he brings forward the idea of Bob, right? Your friend Bob has been at a dinner party and somebody has turned up dead. And what is the probability that your friend Bob is a murderer? And he just sort of works it out. If there are 100 people at the dinner party, then it's one in 100. And like, I that's not at all how I think about friendship. Like, because first of all, if that's my friend Bob, that's my friend Bob. And if I am a loyal friend, I am probably going to stick with Bob, even if Bob has done something terrible. And furthermore, even if Bob is a murderer, and let's say he is, it is unlikely that he's going to murder, like, let's say me, because people are selective about who they kill. Like, there's just like a whole bunch of like psychology that goes into this rather than statistics. And while statistics are an important part of psychology, as any psych professor can tell you, they're just it suggests an incomplete grasp on human behavior, this particular anecdote.
He's a gambler. At the end of the day, that's like, we can go into all these other things, but he saw each and every interaction, every transaction, every single thing he did as a gamble in which he was trying to maximize some value, either financial value for himself or perhaps, maybe if we want to give him the benefit of the doubt, some moral value and some hypothetical weighing machine.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, one of the things that is a problem with utilitarianism, because you wind up starting to view people as means to an end. And I find that morally repugnant. And, you know, it seems like Sam's going to have an awful lot of free time on his hands to look into virtue ethics. And I suggest he do that.
We did an episode on effective altruism, and William McCaskill, after this all came down, of course, had to come out with a statement. And part of it was like, we in the effective altruism have always been against ends justify the means morality. And I'm just like, have you, though? Is that, I know how you're technically going to justify that stance, Will, but I mean,
again, there's a difference between like, well, technically, and like the reality of what people
yes.
think. You also, I figure while we're here, we can bring this up, because last time we had you on, we discussed Elizabeth Holmes, which you were also present for the trial of. And one of the things I was thinking about as this trial came to an end was how I brought this trial up as well a few times, but I was alive for the O.J. Simpson trial. My mom listened to it every single day. And I still remember those radio segments. I still remember hearing about O.J. Simpson every single day. The Holmes trial, I have some memories of as well, and also the buildup to that. You know, the stories coming out were so important, and John Carreyrou and all of that was such a big, important part of the actual story itself. To me, I guess I'm coming in with the bias of, to me, it kind of feels like this one isn't that important compared to Holmes, OJ, these other massive trials that we've seen in the past years, even Madoff, you know, simply admitting to being guilty. Do you disagree with me there? Do you think that this is a very important trial and will be remembered that way?
I don't know how people are going to remember this. I do know that there was a surprising amount of interest in it, among our readers, at least, more than I thought there would be. I think that to the degree that there was, it was sort of more muted than Holmes or OJ. I think that kind of has to do with how obviously guilty he was, you know, like, I think we all kind of figured out what was going on a year ago. So I think that there is some degree of that happening. But the other thing that I think is maybe worth mentioning, this was a very quick rise and fall. And it was also not a very like visual rise and fall. Like if you think about like making a documentary about cryptocurrency, you have to think about like, what are you going to show visibly, because watching people like click on things on a computer is like not all that interesting. And so in terms of like broadcast media, I don't know how much you can really make this into a visual story. So I think that was also part of it, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know how people are going to remember this. This is obviously an enormous scale of fraud. And I think for that reason alone, there are going to be people who remember it. And also just like the absolute clown shoes aspect of how they were doing the fraud. Because for me, like I would come into the courtroom every day and there would be a new crime. You know, like there were days where we casually talked about like the Chinese bribe or like the Thai prostitutes, which were like brought up for like a split second and like never again. And I like maybe almost died of curiosity about that. But there were all of these moments where it was like, oh yeah, and we were backdating transactions to get to $1 billion. Oh yeah, and we were backdating our stock options. Oh yeah, and we were just doing some classic old embezzlement. Like there was just like, there was so much there.
It's kind of fascinating to me that when we reflect on history, like when we look back at the biggest frauds, right? Bernie Madoff has gone down because he was and continues to be the largest fraud in history. And then there's other massive frauds. So like Enron, pretty well remembered. I think people much younger than us don't really know what Enron is. But I think WorldCom, even less so. And then things like long-term capital management or, you know, these other Ponzi schemes that were enormous at the time, whether it be like the 80s, early 90s, whatever. They're completely forgotten. And I think that's like fascinating to me. I don't know what makes a compelling fraud, but I know that this one doesn't feel like it has all the ingredients necessary. Whereas I look at the Elizabeth Holmes fraud and you go like, okay, you have a young, brilliant, attractive woman who lied about health care related blood stuff. Like, that's crazy. That has all the perfect ingredients for people to be obsessed with that forever. Bernie Madoff, insider, everyone knew him, you know, New York, like smartass and brash and well-known, all the right stuff for a crazy story. Then you look at WorldCom and it's like an overweight phys ed teacher accidentally stumbles into telecom and a brilliant auditor catches him red-handed. That doesn't have the same, you know, there's no like, oh, this is crazy. It's just like, oh, they had a big fraud and everyone forgets it. And I'm just like, I can't help but think, I'm not sure in 30 years if anyone will really remember FTX that much. It'll be a footnote, you know? And it's crazy to me because it's such a massive, massive fraud and obvious, like you said.
I definitely think there's just such a clown shoes aspect to it. I mean, it's the farther you get into this, the funnier it gets in a way. Like, it's very dark, but it's also like, this was like a very obvious fraud. This was not like, you know, you think about like WorldCom or Enron, there was like actually kind of some sophisticated stuff going on in terms of balance sheets or whatever. And this was like seven alternate Excel spreadsheets and you can pick your favorite. Like, I think that in and of itself is just like crazy enough.
It also hurts the SBF case in that, to me, the people involved in FTX and Alameda Research, generalizing here, but 25-year-old dudes who think they're good at trading versus when we reflect on Bernie Madoff or Enron, it's like there were pension funds involved. There are old people who had their money in these funds hoping that they could retire on it. Like, it's not the same.
I think there was a pension fund involved. It was like the Ontario teacher or something or other who were investors.
That was Celsius, wasn't it?
No, there were Ontario was involved in FTX. They invested in the 420.
Oh, yeah, Quebec was involved. Quebec was involved in Celsius and Ontario was involved.
You know, and like, just to be clear, like the people who, like the VCs are middlemen, you know, the people whose money they're managing are like family offices and pension funds and endowments and all of that. So like, you know, yeah, it's embarrassing for Sequoia, but who are their clientele?
Well, they won't tell you that. I think that this is going to be memorable because it was the first like crypto fraud to really fully pierce the public consciousness. And I think all of Sam Bankman-Fried's efforts to attract attention leading up to the public becoming aware of his crimes are going to amplify that, right? Like, it's easy for documentaries to allude to the Super Bowl, point to the stadium, run those kind of pictures. And like in the screenplays, it's easy to run it, like run shots of them in their apartment, whatever, trying to build this up and all the drama and like the secret messages between them. And I think there's enough like catch there that it's going to become kind of a touchstone as the way many people remember crypto. I think for many people, Sam Bankman-Fried will serve as kind of one of the last times they think about cryptocurrency. And maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'll be embarrassed in 2 years when Bitcoin is $500,000 or whatever Plan B says it's supposed to be. But, like, I think that the increasing regulatory pressure with this many, like, large-scale failures has burned a lot of people. And so this will kind of be the moment that people point to for that.
I think that's right. And, you know, again, like, it's... Listen, it's totally possible that there will be some big crypto run like 2 to 5 years from now and I'll look stupid, which is fine. It wouldn't be the first time I've looked stupid. But, you know, talking to normal people and like I mean, just like people who are not online all day, people who are not necessarily involved in finance, you know, like the people I run into my yoga classes, my friends who are school teachers, like normal people, like they're all aware of FTX. And there is going to be, I think, this sort of lingering pall from it, because if you think about what Sam was saying publicly, he was saying all of the right things. He was saying, we want regulation. We want to do it the right way. We want to be the good guys. And so how much can you trust the next time somebody comes forward and says, hey, we want regulation, we want to do it the right way, we want to be the good guys? And like, I'll grant you, you know, there are varying levels of how much you can trust people in this industry. And there are certainly people who do, you know, public audits of their work or who are disclosing what wallets they're using. There are more and less trustworthy people in the crypto space. But for the average person who doesn't actually know any of that, I think this is a very big moment. I think this is the sort of thing that can be really defining for people. And if you think about like the commercials, you have, I think it was the Steph Curry commercial where he's like, I don't know anything about crypto, but I don't have to because I have FTX. And like, if that's who got on FTX and this was the experience they had, they're probably not coming back to this asset class.
Especially since now Steph Curry fans can, you know, just do all their gambling on FanDuel and the, you know, legalized sports gambling sites.
I know that the end of this trial was a bit of a somber affair, and I know it probably was pretty lame for you to end up having to part ways with so many of these different journalists that you were able to spend time with over there in New York City. The part I'm going to miss about this trial is basically reading all of the different perspectives that I've been able to get constantly and consistently, oftentimes from people who aren't necessarily covering cryptocurrency, which has been really nice as well. But I think the main sense that I got the day that the trial ended was overwhelming relief. Like, we're done with this now. Did you feel that at all at the end of this trial, or was it pretty much just somber and sad to be parting ways with the other journalists?
I was pretty excited to sleep is the main emotion I was experiencing. I was like, oh, yes, I'm gonna get some sleep. No, you know, I met a lot of people whose work I really admire, you know, from a wide variety of outlets, and that was a pleasure. One of the things that I like about stuff like this is because there are so many of us covering the same thing, if you are reading the other coverage, you can actually really improve your craft by seeing how other people are approaching it. And so that, you know, from a creative perspective was pretty great. And then there was also, I think Katie Baker talked about this, watching the way that the prosecution used storytelling. And the way that they paced their witnesses and thought about, you know, how to sort of create these narrative peaks and valleys. That was really interesting, too. So there were, you know, on that level, there were a lot of really interesting things that I'm probably going to be sorting through for a while. Not least because it was just a really intense experience. Like, I kind of got shot out of a cannon, you know. I didn't do anything other than this for a month of my life. I would, you know, go stand outside the courtroom, and then I would sit in court all day, and then I would go home and write and edit and put things in layout and put it up on the site and then immediately go to bed. There is a kind of relief to have a life again. Very excited to, you know, go back to be home, first of all, and have a kitchen that is not the size of a postage stamp. It was just a lot of emotions at once in a very intense way that I probably will be thinking about for a while.
Bennett, you done? You good? No more questions?
I've got no more questions. I did find out betonline.ag has the over-under for Sam Bankman-Fried's sentence at 80.5.
They think he's going to get 80 years?
I think it's a very poorly set line, but hey, I'm not offering gambling advice on this podcast.
Holy shit, we got to start gambling in these markets, Bennett. What the hell? Anyway, Cascoin is fine.